Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The 1% want us atomized and divided. They want us in front of our TV sets and in front of our computer screens and our cell phones, once again, atomized and divided.
That's the voice of Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the Black Agenda Report. On this week's show, we speak to Bruce about Black Lives Matter, racism in America, and the current U.S. election cycle. So stay tuned. On the line, I have Bruce Dixon, a longtime activist and co-founder of the Black Agenda Report, and he is currently the managing editor. Hey, welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thanks for inviting me, Stuart.
Now, the visibility of the racial divide in America has never been so stark. We have Donald Trump talking about building walls, limiting immigration of Muslims, the emergence of the Black Lives Matter. Can you speak to the catalyst of this moment, and what was the catalyst for Black Lives Matter, and where are we right now?
Well, Black Lives Matter is, strictly speaking, is a hashtag, a slogan, and the people who came up with it were three black women, Opal Tometi, Alicia Garza, and Patrice Cullors, a couple of years ago. The thing about slogans and hashtags is that they can be adopted by anybody, and their content is often whatever you decide their content is. So there is an official Black Lives Matter network / organization, you know, that does exist. But nowadays, people are ascribing anything that black people, especially young black people, do as a product or outgrowth or outcome or production of Black Lives Matter. So it's kind of a fluid term that means, to some extent, whatever you want it to mean. And then again, it also means almost anything that young black people do that's political now is ascribed to Black Lives Matter, rightly or wrongly.
Recently at the Republican National Convention, they were saying, you know, Blue Lives Matter, and they were trying to link up these recent police killings to the Black Lives Matter movement. And I recently heard a commentary on one of these talk radio shows saying that they wish prosecutors would stop charging police because you're never going to get a conviction without a third-party oversight. Your thoughts on the recent rash of shootings? You wrote an article about this that kind of counteracts some of the information that's out there.
Well, malicious authoritarians are always going to bend the news and bend reality to fit their quest for more power over the lives of ordinary people. So it's pretty much par for the course for malicious authoritarians, once again, including the representatives of police unions, politicians of both parties, public figures like Rudy Giuliani and such. It's perfectly normal for them to absolve in advance cops who murder and blame it on the broad public movement against police impunity and against police immunity from the laws that bind the rest of us against assault and murder. It's just par for the course. It's what malicious authoritarians do, is try to justify and expand their power to operate on behalf of the 1%.
Underneath this authoritarianism and this kind of police state that we're seeing is a military culture. Your article talks about the shooters in Baton Rouge and Dallas. Can you touch on that? And who were these shooters and what was their background?
Both the Dallas and the Baton Rouge shooter had backgrounds in the U.S. military. And both of them seem to have had, you know, similar, in some ways, psychological profiles, loners and such. It seems that this is something that they have in common with a lot of cops. We don't know what the percentage of military veterans among police is, because the U.S. Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, does not keep that particular stat. It's a question they don't ask. The answer is kind of hard to come up with. But it's very likely that the percentage of military veterans among cops is as high or higher than any other profession you can name, except Pentagon employees and employees of the Department of Homeland Security. And it's a known fact that in the military, in the U.S. military, seeking psychological help or admitting that you need psychological help is often the end of your career. It's frowned upon. The U.S. military is a twisted, wretched place where two out of every five women report being sexually assaulted during their military careers, and that may be an undercount. It's a place where reporting, not committing, but reporting those assaults can be the end of your military career. And so this is the kind of world that our police come from, a large number of them. And it's the world that these two shooters also come from. And I think it's about time that we acknowledge that there's a link between the havoc and destruction that we sow overseas, young men who were born and brought up here in the States, misusing their bodies, their energies, and their lives, and some of the mayhem and murder that goes on here on the streets of the U.S.
I'm on this news feed, and I get all this email regarding U.S. military operations. And today, for the first time in a long time, they showed a map of just U.S. bases in Africa and Southeast Asia. It's overwhelming, the size and scale of the U.S. military. But we have also seen the militarization of poor neighborhoods and military equipment on the streets of America. But you don't get them in rich neighborhoods in New York or San Francisco. It's mainly these poor neighborhoods, and it kind of becomes a new normal with deadly consequences. How do we stem this kind of military culture emerging into our streets? How do we stem that tide?
Well, if you've got a recent map of military bases in Asia and Africa, I wish you'd forward that one to me, because I could use that for some work I'm doing. Policing is the only realm in which government directly interferes with the lives of poor people. They've put police in the position of enforcing what we call a mass incarceration state. The United States right now leads the world in the number of people it locks up, and it locks people up longer and more often for things that are minor offenses everywhere else in the world, or not even offenses at all, worth prosecuting. And this kind of militarized law enforcement is always directed first and foremost at non-white people and at poor people. These are things that, as you remarked, you just don't see in rich neighborhoods, because that's not the way cops have learned and socialized each other and been permitted to do their job. They've been unleashed upon poor neighborhoods, which are supposedly filled with pathology and pathological actors and drugs and whatnot, and the war on drugs has been the excuse for disproportionate presence of law enforcement, this over-policing in black and brown and poor neighborhoods all over the country. And the military thing just goes with it. You've got a military-industrial complex, of course. The United States produces military equipment for half the armies in the world, probably. So it's no surprise that some of that equipment should wind up right here on our shores. It can't be a surprise. And there is an inextricable link, between the behaviors of our military and the behaviors of police and correctional officials here. It cannot have escaped anyone's notice that the rank-and-file torturers at Abu Ghraib were, in civilian life, Pennsylvania prison guards. These are connections which our media ought to be making. And these are connections which the psychological profession also ought to be making, but they're not.
It's incredible. And I want to touch on something you said, and that is I was watching one of these Fox News debates about crime in the United States, and they had a former sergeant, and he said, well, black people are more likely to be shot because they commit most of the crimes in America, and look at the statistics. And the other guest quite rightly pointed out, he says, well, when you have all the road checks, when you have all the spot checks, and all the random stop and frisks in poor neighborhoods, of course you're going to produce lopsided statistics. So it's about this culture of racism, and that's within...
Yeah, what that gentleman was saying is that many of the crime stats are not crime stats at all. They are police activity stats. And so they measure the activity of police. And, you know, not the presence of crime. You know, if you've got a business here and low-wage workers are cheated out of billions of dollars every month in the United States. Nobody ever goes to jail for that. So, and as a matter of fact, the amount of money people are cheated out of in wage theft is several times that stolen from people in robberies and burglaries in the United States. You know, so there's a crime wave. There's all kinds of crime waves going on. But, you know, the police activity is what it is. And it's not necessarily about the crimes committed against poor people. It's the crimes that enable them to continue and justify the mass incarceration state and these malicious authoritarians.
I want to touch upon something that occurred to me. I was watching the RNC convention, and like, who is this VP candidate, and what's why him? Which the mainstream media really hasn't asked. And then I realized, well, he's the governor of Senator Indiana, which is one of the worst regressive labor states in the union. And a lot of Ontario and Canadian jobs are moving to Indiana because of their anti-union law. So when you want to talk about low-paying jobs, you can see that Trump really chose the right man for the job. Do you have any thoughts about this man?
Yeah, he's Pence has tried to make Indiana a right-to-work state. Right-to-work is a concoction in U.S. law that basically says that unions are banned from being able to automatically enroll people and automatically collect dues, which makes it a little harder to organize unions, and contains some other provisions too. But the really, really striking thing about that is that Thomas Kane, who's the Democratic VP candidate, is not much different from Mike Pence on a lot of these wage issues.
Oh,
you know, he's the governor of a right-to-work state, and he has defended anti-union legislation, you know, himself. And Democrats are just not much better on labor questions, except rhetorically during election cycles. When it's not an election cycle, they may campaign a bit differently than Republicans, but they govern pretty much the same as Republicans. Canadians may remember back 8 years ago when Barack Obama was campaigning for president in the Democratic primaries, he would make appearances in places like Ohio and Indiana and talk about renegotiating NAFTA. And then at the same time, one of his operatives, the black former mayor of Houston, Texas, I think was the trade envoy to Canada, and he was quoted in the papers there as saying, oh, don't worry about him. He's got to say that. It's election season, and that's what the rubes have to hear. But don't worry, we're not going to renegotiate NAFTA.
You know,
you know, so this is the way they are. And Mike Pence there's really not a great deal of space between the Republicans' vice presidential candidate and the Democrats' vice presidential candidate.
It makes me really sad to hear this, because we all have this illusion, and I think we spoke to Glenn Ford a couple of years ago, and he said that people have these fantasies and then they attach it to Barack Obama that he's going to do these great, amazing things, but it didn't, a lot of it didn't materialize. Now, what on earth are Americans going to do? Because they can vote for, hold their nose and vote for Hillary, or they can vote for this kind of xenophobic monster, named Donald Trump. Where can people put this information and how can they express themselves politically?
Well, I'm the co-chair of the Georgia Green Party in my home state here, and you know, we've worked to get our own presidential candidate, Dr. Jill Stein, on the ballot, and she's going to be in the ballot in at least 40 or 45 states, we believe, and so there will be alternatives for most Americans to cast a vote in some other direction, to cast a vote for a candidate who believes that we need to make a deliberate plan to get the heck off of fossil fuels, period, and transform our economy with a Green New Deal that you know, creates real jobs for real people where they need to be. A party that opposes the bipartisan project of both parties in privatizing public education. A party that opposes war. Jill Stein is, in fact, the Green Party's Jill Stein is, in fact, the only anti-privatization candidate in the race. She's the only anti-war and peace candidate in the race. Even Bernie Sanders was saying that drones and drone warfare was a good idea. You know, so, and Bernie Sanders also has been known to say that we ought to really step up our arming of our surrogate powers, you know, like Saudi Arabia. You know, so, you know, people do have alternatives in some cases, and we have to work harder to make those alternatives available to more people.
If I make this argument, and I, people might listen to this when they listen to this, and they'll say, come on, Bruce, all you're doing is electing Trump because the progressive vote will just disappear and we will have to put up with Trump. Surely the Democrats have some more progressive policies than the Republicans, and I can't throw my vote away. So how would you respond to people like that?
A vote cast in fear is a vote thrown away. If your vote means anything, then nobody should be able to scare you or blackmail you into voting for what you don't want. Eugene Debs used to say that he'd rather vote for what he did want and not get it than vote for what he didn't want and get that. When you vote for Hillary Clinton, you're voting for a real warmonger who really has experience at doing, at overthrowing governments, at starting wars, and who tells much better lies than Mr. Trump does. You're voting for somebody who actually has experience doing these devilish things. You're voting for someone who was instrumental in overthrowing the elected government of a country on the borders of Russia, on the borders of nuclear-armed Russia, and arming and financing neo-Nazi groups in the Ukraine to wreak havoc in parts of that place, and you know, which has pushed U.S. Military bases, NATO bases, like I said, to the borders of Russia. This is not a small thing. It really seems that while Republicans talk more evil, Democrats are often able to do more evil. NAFTA was not passed under a Republican president. NAFTA came up and failed twice under the first President Bush. And then when Clinton was elected, Clinton rallied enough congressional Democrats behind it to pass it. All right. George Bush also could not have done the so-called welfare reform that, you know, decimated families and threw huge numbers of people onto the low-wage market without child care. George Bush couldn't have done that. Only Clinton could have done it, and Clinton did do it. When Barack Obama came into office, the U.S. was only in a handful of African countries. Now, we've got bases throughout the African continent. We're flying drone missions out of Mali, and we're, you know, bombing people in Somalia and any number of other places. We're flying drone missions over the Congo now. You know, so Barack has been able to do things that a Republican president could not do. Could not do. Would have been protested against it and blocked. But the fact that he's a Democrat has made him the more effective evil. Not the lesser evil, but the more effective evil.
I can feel a lot of depressed people hearing this. And also, you know, as just as a point in Canada, it was a conservative government that signed off on NAFTA, and the oppositional party said, when we get in power, we're going to repeal it, and it never got repealed. So I guess...
Yeah, good luck with that.
We're getting lied to all the time. Now, for people who are listening at home and they can see the state of racism and the daily news and who just feel kind of hopeless, what advice do you give to ordinary people to kind of resist and to kind of take their own agency and their own communities back?
Unhook yourselves from the TV and unhook yourselves even from some of your social media and talk to your own neighbors. Talk to your own neighbors. Don't confine your activism to collectivism. If you're going to build the kind of world you want, you've got to start right next to you, and you've got to start making common cause with your neighbors. And that's where everything starts. If you can't organize in the community and the workplace and the church and where you live and go to school, then what's it all about? What's it all about? The 1% want us atomized and divided. They want us in front of our TV sets and in front of our computer screens and our cell phones. Once again, atomized and divided. You know, we need to make human connections and put some skin in the game. We've got to operate more in meat space and less in cyberspace, I think.
Well, put in just as an example, here in BC, we've had a terrible housing crisis. Like, literally, like 90% of the population can't afford to buy a home here, and there's so much foreign investment flipping homes that over the last 2 years, we've seen a lot of home renovations. So people started squatting in properties, and people have started protesting, and now they're talking about adding more taxes and taking action on this issue. But it didn't come out of anywhere. It didn't just commanded the goodwill of the politicians. It came out of a lot of people kind of resisting.
That's the way capitalism works. Under capitalism, no neighborhood of poor people is safe, because the only value that a neighborhood of poor people has is the value that can be realized by flipping it. Because capitalism, under capitalism, they measure economic health by property values. You see? And so then, you know, when blacks and minorities buy into a neighborhood, they automatically lower the property values, you see? And like I said, the value, the only value that a working-class neighborhood, a poor neighborhood has, is the value that you can realize by driving those people out and gentrifying it. So the only solution to that is, just as you say, not an individual solution, but a collective solution. Organizing your neighborhoods and taking collective action and demanding, you know, that property and the right to a home, the right to a place to live, be handled by something other than the so-called free market.
Exactly. I guess the latest stats said there's 10,000 empty homes in Vancouver, empty condos, and less than 1% vacancy rate. So literally people are being squeezed out. Now I'm coming to the end. Please tell people how they can find your articles and the Black Agenda Report, and also any final comments about this moment of time, this moment in history.
You can find Black Agenda Report on the web at www.blackagendareport.com. And we've been publishing every week for 10 years now, almost 11 years. And we are one of the key voices in the United States of the Black Left. And we're living through an historic time here when both of the two major parties are basically destroying themselves. And if we're lucky, very soon, there will be no Republican Party and there will be no Democratic Party as we know it. And that's when things actually change, is when there are upheavals and some of these parties get dissolved. The last time a political party dissolved in the United States, I think, was the Civil War 140 years ago. These are massive realignments that have the potential for massive change. And so we may be living through one of those moments. So it is time, once again, like I said, to detach a little bit from your media connections and your social media and get with your neighbors and talk to your neighbors and organize something in meat space, not cyberspace.
Thank you so much for taking the time on short notice to do this interview, and hopefully we'll speak soon.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.